is the 27th of April, 1999, and we are in his office at Davidson College. And I thought I would start by just asking a little bit about your own schooling. Are you from Charlotte originally?
I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, where I attended private schools. And then I came to Davidson in 1968 and graduated in 1972 with a degree in English. And then I was sent out to Los Angeles, California, to sell sandpaper by 3M Company. And I did that for 2 years after graduating. I got married while I was out there to my college girlfriend and came back then to Charlotte where she could get a job teaching. And then went to UNCC and got certified to teach. There. That took me about 16 months to do, during which time I practice taught at West Charlotte High School and eventually was hired on there full time to teach English and to coach soccer.
Boys or girls?
Well, at that time there was just boys, although the next to last year that I was at West Charlotte, I started the girls' soccer program. There too.
I interviewed a young woman, Carrie Culp. I don't know if she played soccer. I don't know if she was on your team.
She was, and coached her younger brother also, and her father was, you know, one of our main fans, and so I knew her parents as well. Carrie became a Moorhead Scholar.
How did you come to be teaching specifically at West Charlotte? Was this a decision you had made, or just what happened?
I think that it was because I did my practice teaching there, and I think that I practice taught there because my wife, who worked in the school system, sort of knew a good teacher there and sort of recommended that I practice teach with her. So I did not know much about West Charlotte and did not actively seek to teach there. I had done practice, substitute teaching at Olympic High School for about a year before that.
What was your first impression of West Charlotte?
Since I had never been in a public school before, I did not have any sort of pre-existing notions of what a public school would be, so I just assumed that's what a public school was. When I first started, I had no real knowledge or appreciation for its role in the black community. I learned after being there for several years just how old a school it was, how loyal the black alumni have been for decades and still are. So I was, at that point, just trying to manage my classes and teach and all that. So in that sense, it could have been any school.
How did you come, you came to learn about what the school meant? How did you learn that? How did that?
I suppose through maybe a series of crises or events. West Charlotte was not the school that most white students wanted to be assigned to from junior high. And they would tell stories, for example, at Myers Park High School, where, let me rephrase that, some of them came from the junior high at that point, I guess middle school these days, that fed both Myers Park and West Charlotte. The majority of those students were sent to Myers Park, about two-thirds of them. So it was sort of the unlucky minority of kids who lived in the Myers Park neighborhood who were assigned to West Charlotte. So they would come to us, and these were mainly white students, So when they came to us and I would teach them, then I would hear about these stories where they were ridiculed for going to, quote, West Chocolate High, not just by students, but also by principals and administrators at these junior highs. And so then I sort of realized that, sort of through adversity, that West Charlotte is sort of a cause as well as, you know, just a high school. And then other memorable and emotional events occurred at West Charlotte in those early years where I learned that we have to sort of fight for respect. And then once one has been around that school for a while, you get glimpses of the alumni support, both at athletic events, but then also through PTA meetings and elsewhere. So part of that, sort of seeing the African-American historical perspective comes over years of being there, learning the sort of white perspective came very quickly to me, because the majority of my students in the advanced classes anyway were white, of course. So there were other events too, but it's one of those situations, I think, where one's identity is thrust upon one. It's not really freely chosen.
Is that, would you see a change in these students over the years that they were at West Charlotte, or would they essentially maintain the same attitude?
Well, I think the white students who came from the sort of middle class and upper middle class neighborhoods to West Charlotte were had developed as sort of a tradition among themselves of going to West Charlotte and being proud of it. I think that their older brothers and sisters who came to West Charlotte in the early days of integration sort of started to create that tradition and that sense that West Charlotte was, first of all, just a lot of fun because of the diversity. Secondly, it had a lot of bright students, so there were a lot of academic successes. And also the athletic successes, which were mainly attributable to the black athletes, were also something that were fun and they could take pride in. So by the time I was there in 1976 and 77 starting, these younger brothers and sisters came to West Charlotte with a sense that they were at a really good place, in a unique place. But just about all those students graduated with a real sense of pride in West Charlotte. And they still have a great deal of pride for having gone there.
Did you develop that pride as well? Is that something that...
Sure. Well, yeah, there's importance, as you know, to West Charlotte on lots of different levels. But, you know, on one level, I considered myself and my students competing against students from Myers Park and East Mecklenburg, which at that time were the sort of the affluent, academically sort of flagship schools in the school system. And then South Mech, when it opened, was that way too. But especially with Myers Park, because so many of our students came from common feeder areas with Myers Park High School. So, and one thing that I and a couple other teachers did was to start a humanities program at West Charlotte, which was basically an English and history integrated curriculum, at least somewhat integrated. And because Myers Park for years had had such a course. Now they did theirs in 10th grade and it was sort of world studies. And we did ours both in 10th grade and 11th grade. But one of the reasons for doing it was purely competition. Because the Myers Park teachers would go into the junior highs and talk to the 9th graders and try to recruit them to sign up for the humanities program. Well, the students who were assigned to West Charlotte, of course, did not have any teachers coming into their advanced classes talking to them about West Charlotte's curriculum. The only exception to that was the open school component, where they might get some of that. But a lot of the students whom we had in common really were not interested in open education. The students, of course, who went to Piedmont Open Middle School were, but the others weren't. So anyway, part of that reason for establishing that program was purely competitive.
Would you hold Myers Park up in your classroom and tell the students they had to be better than Myers Park? Is that something you would do?
Didn't have to. They brought that with them. Now, we would do that with soccer, the soccer team. There's no question about that, because they had, especially in my early years, just more talent and better teams, and had gained some fame across the state for the strength of their soccer program, because it was one of the first schools that had a soccer team. And when I came to West Charlotte, the coach previously had been fired for hitting a referee, so the West Charlotte program was in disarray. But one of my points of pride is that over the years we built that program until eventually we were conference champions and beat East Mecklenburg and Myers Park and South Mecklenburg one year. And we could compete on that level as well.
It's interesting to see rivalries change. Prior, of course, they had Second Ward as the big rival. It's kind of interesting to think about Myers Park kind of becoming, through the white students.
That's right, through the white students. And with the black students, the schools that, you know, they sort of had natural rivalries with were Harding, West Mecklenburg to a lesser degree, and Myers Park to a certain extent, because all those schools had a large, except for Myers Park, had a large number of black students and therefore black athletes. And a lot of students who were, not a lot, some black students who were assigned to other neighborhoods would finagle their way to West Charlotte. Now, of course, the opposite was true with white athletes who played soccer, for example. I can go into great detail about how the white parents and their children falsified addresses and all that so they could avoid busing to West Charlotte. And there were some incidents where that came to play with soccer, because athletics has sort of these additional rules statewide as to how students can transfer from one school to another. And there are sort of competition aspects to finagling one's way to a school they're not really assigned to.
Yes. I'm interested in, one of the things that I'm interested in, I'm going to talk about sports a little bit later, because that's obviously, very significant aspect of the school, but to talk a little bit about academics and to talk about the classroom. And I'm curious as to whether you saw continuities between your classes and what you taught in your classes and the school as a whole, or if you, the classroom was a different place from the rest of the school.
Well, let me say that one of the things that made West Charlotte successful was that it had, in addition to some of the brightest and most affluent students, white students in the city, it had some of the brightest and most affluent black students in the city. Therefore, the advanced classes were more integrated or more easily integrated than they would have been otherwise. So right away, the school was able to avoid some of the sort of dichotomy that we see at other schools when it comes to integration. That meant, too, that West Charlotte had student leadership, well, student and parent leadership from both the black and the white communities. That was a great advantage. My perception of the student body as a whole at West Charlotte was that it had a lot of these bright students, was able to offer a wide variety of gifted and talented classes as well as advanced placement classes. It also had a lot of poor families in their district. And it seemed to have maybe fewer students in between. So that's my perception. And I don't know whether that's an advantage or not when it comes to just kids getting along, mm-hmm. in a way. But certainly my impression was that they did get along. Now, in my early years, in 76 and 77, there were several times during the year where there were sort of racial fights, but not like it was in the early days, apparently, of integration at West Charlotte and other schools. I was at Olympic substituting, in 70, I guess it was 75, and there were some terrible brawls at Olympic. But the West Charlotte students got along, and they got along in the classroom as well as outside the classroom. The white students, for the most part, took delight in being immersed in the black culture. I mean, they liked the music, they liked the energy. They enjoyed the language. They didn't resent the fact that only a handful of the members of the band were white. They just enjoyed the band. The advanced students were both very competent and successful, whether they were African American or white. There were stories that, for example, that Harvard would call down to Marge Belton, who was a guidance counselor at that time, every year and ask her, "Who's your brightest black student?" And so for a while there was quite, every year a black student who would be accepted at Harvard and go up there. And that was true with other highly selective colleges. Both blacks and whites were being accepted there. So I think in that regard it worked well.
Did it seem to you when you were there like it was, to some extent, an African American school? Did it still feel like that, or did you not feel that?
Well, when I was there, I think, at least in the beginning, the white ratio was probably it was probably 40 or 45%. Over the years, the white ratio dwindled, especially with the introduction of the magnet programs. We can talk about that later, but the white ratio dwindled. And then at one point, I guess it was around in the early 80s at some point, West Charlotte became a second site for the English as a Second Language program. Myers Park was the first site, and I think that when West Charlotte became the second site, that took my impression again. This might be somewhat prejudiced. That took some of the pressure off of the school board to keep the white ratio up, because they could count these Asians and others in that program as being non-blacks. And of course now the white ratio is quite small at West Charlotte. I think most people don't realize just how small it is.
What did you think about that as that was happening? I mean, I guess you saw this sort of number of white students shrinking. You experienced that. What did you think about that as it was happening?
Well, I considered it a threat to West Charlotte's future. for a number of reasons. If you fall below a critical mass, then you can't offer as many advanced placement classes and advanced classes and that sort of thing. Because it wasn't just white students; it was students from the more affluent neighborhoods, like Eastover and Myers Park, the areas around UNC and the Cotswold neighborhood. And once you fall below a certain critical mass, then the image of the school is that it's a black school, you know, in the public's mind, and not the flagship for integration. So I saw it as a threat. Now, after I finished teaching, and I guess at the end of 87, very beginning of 88, I still was involved with West Charlotte because my two sons went to West Charlotte. So I was a parent there, and I was involved several years with the PTSA and that sort of thing. During that time, West Charlotte had, in these last 8 years or so, West Charlotte has had quite a few, as it always has had, principal changes. And after Barbara Ledford was principal, and she was a white female, then the superintendents, John Murphy and now Eric Smith, apparently feel compelled that they must have a black principal at that school. We have to understand that the black parents and alumni and people in the community have a different view of West Charlotte and different desires for it. I don't think that they're as proud of the fact that it was the flagship school for integration in Charlotte-Mecklenburg as they were of just of its historical African-American background. And I think that they wanted and want to be sure that West Charlotte remains a school that they can be proud of. And they can be proud of that school even if there are no white students there. I think that the principals who have come in recent years first are impressed with the pride of the black alumni and community. Then I think it takes them a couple years to realize that they need the sort of more affluent white families for two reasons. One is that they need their political support downtown. The other reason is that they need the test scores for those kids. And this was especially true when John Murphy was the superintendent and he was so adamant about test scores. But of course what's happened to West Charlotte is that integration in the last 10 years has become less and less important to the powers that be in Charlotte and to the school board and to the administration. Of course, they contend that it's very important, but in reality, it became of secondary importance to sort of keeping faith in the public schools on the part of white citizens. And so my interpretation of events was that the downtown powers, especially, who controlled the school board at the time that John Murphy was, that Peter Relic was sort of let go and John Murphy was hired, wanted the superintendent, the next superintendent, and that was Murphy, to see if they could take the easy route of maintaining integrated schools by using magnets, sort of the carrot instead of the stick of busing. So Murphy did that. But once that decision was made that was going to be the direction for Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, then West Charlotte High School is no longer important for the sake of integration. But if you could, whereas it was before, because if you could bus white kids across town, past two or three other high schools, into a black neighborhood, and they could still get a good education and go to great school colleges from there and be happy doing it all, then busing can work. So West Charlotte's sort of difficulties, and I think in the last, let's say, 10 or 12 years, I think have really originated with the desire of the leadership in the community to get away from forced busing as much as they can.
So you say that students might not necessarily have chosen to go to West Charlotte, but they were happy once they got there, so it worked. I mean, is that...
Yes. But at the same time, though, the students who went to West Charlotte, at least the white students who went, were somehow either came to the school or turned out to be more cosmopolitan than students at a lot of other schools, other than its, quote, neighborhood schools. And they sort of took delight in the fact that the student body was composed of students who came from 12 to 15 junior high schools around the county. A lot of those students, black and white, often said to me that that was a great advantage at West Charlotte, because if they were not, let's say, the most popular students in their junior high, then they got to start over again at West Charlotte. They could run for office and be elected. They could get involved with the clubs and be leaders in the clubs. Whereas at the other schools, the leaders in junior high automatically sort of stepped into those roles at the high school level.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah. So that was an advantage. The students at West Charlotte were more sophisticated, and I think that maybe it was because the less sophisticated students were naturally selected out and sent to private school. So West Charlotte High School could put on plays that, because of their provocative nature, could never be staged at any other high school in Charlotte.
What would be an example of one of those?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they could do Equus. They could do plays that dealt, that had profanity, semi-nudity. They would do plays that had racial themes that probably were just not of interest at other schools. And that was sort of delightful. It was almost an avant-garde, sort of atmosphere there. Charles LeBord, who's a principal now, I think he's was the drama professor for years at West Charlotte, and he was fabulous, and he put on these plays, and, I mean, these are plays he could never do anyplace else. And I don't know that they do plays like this now at West Charlotte or not. I mean, maybe the times have changed, but the atmosphere and the energy at that school were just invigorating. Because you had these bright students, both black and white, who they were bold, they were assertive, they were more mature. They would do they wanted to do serious things. And you had the other students who may have not have had the advantages in life, but they had this great energy about them, you know. And they brought their own style, and you saw that in the band and on the athletic fields and in the hallways. And it was just a very invigorating mix of students and of energy. And on top of that, you had the open program students who were even more avant-garde and very creative. Some of them were just a little different than everybody. So you had this sense that you really weren't in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's more like we were, you know, in a northern city somewhere on the, you know, near downtown. It was fabulous.
And I guess very different from what your own experience had been in school.
My own experience was Lutheran parochial schools for the first 8 years, and then a small private high school, completely white, as I remember, in Baltimore, that was extremely sort of classic in its approach to education. But the interest, and then of course Davidson College, which was lily white and extremely classical in its approach to education and all that. But at least between my high school and West Charlotte, there were a lot of similarities. My high school was wonderful because the teachers encouraged free speech, open-mindedness, skepticism. It was just a liberating atmosphere. Of course, that's less true with Davidson, but they had that. I think also the power of the liberal arts is that even though it's an academic endeavor, one learns to deal with different ideas, and through literature, different characters. One learns that ambiguity exists in the world, and one needs to be able to accept that fact and handle it. And so from a sort of an intellectual point of view, I was very prepared for a school like West Charlotte, even though I had never really been around black people before. Shoot, I hadn't been around women before, because all these schools I went to were all male.
Well, in that sense, did you find that teaching literature at a place like West Charlotte, where the students were in this atmosphere of diversity and energy, did that help? Did you feel that you saw that reflected in the way students approach literature?
The great thing about teaching literature at West Charlotte was that you could teach ideas to these students. They loved ideas. They loved new ideas. They loved perspectives different than their own. This was true for black students as well as white students. Because the students were more sophisticated, you could teach things you couldn't teach other places. For example, I became known for teaching Moby Dick to my advanced classes, to the 11th grade humanities classes and others. And first of all, as you know, Moby Dick is very long. It's very philosophical and intellectual. And these students could handle it, and most of them would actually read the whole book, you know, or at least most of it, and could do that, which was sort of amazing. High school teachers nationwide had long given up teaching Moby Dick. But at the same time, I could also teach Huckleberry Finn. And Huckleberry Finn was a very appropriate story for West Charlotte because it's really about black people and white children getting along and how they learn to respect each other. And that was a theme that these students, both black and white, could appreciate. Even though that novel was filled with the N-word. Now, I did notice that by the time I was leaving in the late 80s, it became more and more risky to teach literature that would have racial slurs in it. We could read books like Invisible Man, where they were written from a black perspective, and where you might have that sort of thing. But it became just a little more awkward. But nevertheless, could teach both very sort of high-level intellectual books, but then also books that were sort of threatening in their content to the students themselves. And then you could teach, again, sort of sophisticated books like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, because you didn't have this sort of fundamentalist Christian presence in the school like you had at a lot of the other high schools in Charlotte. So, I mean, I was never accused of doing the work of the devil because I was teaching some of these really American classics, you know. So teaching literature at West Charlotte was just fabulous because the class discussions were so great. And I think more sort of rewarding than probably teaching math or science would be. And I know that teaching history was similarly rewarding for the history teachers.
How would you deal with, say, with Huckleberry Finn, with this difficult content? How would you approach doing that with your students?
Well, it depended on the level of the class. For those who are college bound, the actual language of the book and then the treatment of Jim at the end of the book or by the end of the book was easier than it would be with the, let's say, regular classes where the students weren't as sophisticated. They maybe weren't as sort of self-confident. So they would be threatened more by the racial slurs or whatever. At least the black students would be maybe threatened more by that. And the white students would probably do a little more snickering, you know, than those in the advanced classes. So that means that you, as a teacher, you had to be sure, let's say, in the regular classes, to prepare the students for the chapters they were going to read that night. You would have to tell them that about the language, about what was going to happen, but then you'd have to sort of sell them, you know, that's okay, we can deal with this, or, you know, Twain's not a racist. I mean, so that, you know, that sort of thing. It took a little more sensitivity and sort of foresight, you know, I thought on my part. With the advanced classes, the themes and then the vernacular descriptions were so inspiring to those students that's what they would focus on. In the regular classes, there wasn't that level of appreciation for what Twain had done in that book, and so there would be more focusing on, you know, racial aspects of it, because that's what they seem to be more caught up in that in their daily lives.
Whereas these higher level students, that wasn't as much of an issue for them.
No,
I
don't think so. I think that the upper middle class black students just had such strong self concepts and all that they didn't mind if they read the N-word over and over and over again in the book. I mean, they weren't particularly threatened by that. You know, because you also had in that book sort of this sort of odd situation too, where a lot of the regular, where a lot of the black students who were in the regular classes would laugh just out loud at these passages where Huck would refer to Jim as a nigger, because they would tease each other with that word. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd call each other, and they would get a kick out of some of that stuff. You know, you just had to be really sure that you didn't have the white kids start using that word, because then the black kids would take that as a threat. You know? So, actually, some of the passages in there, the students in the regular classes found more humorous than those in the advanced classes.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, they appreciated the book on a more literal level. You know, they would laugh about at the end Jim's attempts to escape from the shed he was kept in or whatever, you know. I mean, whereas those advanced students are so trained to look for themes and characters and images in these more sophisticated parts of literary criticism, you know, that they wouldn't spend much time really thinking about that. But in the humanities program, we taught the classics. We tried to teach them in a creative way that was less teacher-centered than what you would find at a place like Davidson, for example. But we wanted to teach the classics. So we so the first semester when we did 19th century novels, we taught Scarlet Letter and Huckleberry Finn and Red Badge of Courage and Moby Dick and all that. And then second semester, I taught, what were some of them? The Crucible and Death of a Salesman and Great Gatsby and maybe One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, because it sort of reflected the attitudes of the 60s and anti-establishment feelings and all of that. And in the humanities program, because they were also studying the history of America at, in the same periods that we would read the books, we tried to get sort of a correlation going there. And so we were able to do that with quite a few of the novels.
Was there ever any pressure to teach books with black authors? This is, you know, the canon you're talking about.
Yeah, well, it was interesting what I saw there during my time. I mean, we did teach like Invisible Man, and we looked for other sort of shorter selections, slave narratives, and that sort of thing. And in the regular classes, there was more of that than there was in the advanced classes. But what was interesting is that when I first went there, we're talking about the late 70s, West Charlotte had a curriculum where, especially for seniors in the English department, there were a lot of different course offerings. And they were teaching courses with female authors, black literature, just others that were very specialized courses. And then when we established the humanities program, that was almost like a counterbalance to that sort of approach, although the humanities program was only for 10th and 11th grade. You know, now 12th grade was supposed to be British and World Literature. And there was much more, a greater menu of courses. But then what I saw was that during the 80s, all this choice was cut out. And I think part of that was downtown. I think downtown, as well as the state, if I remember correctly, issued these statewide curriculums. This was the first wave of educational reform hitting North Carolina. And what that really translated into was controlled by the central bureaucracy, because they thought there was just far too much liberalism in, I mean, the state legislature, you can just see this happening, too much liberalism in the teaching and in the curriculum, and we've got to get control so that we can test people, and then we can compare, and we can pay teachers accordingly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so that all was happening in the 80s. And even an assistant superintendent or deputy superintendent under Jay Robinson in the 80s, named Bob Haynes, I heard was sort of proud of the fact that the curriculum in Charlotte-Mecklenburg had been standardized and universalized to the extent that a student could transfer from one school to another in the middle of a semester and still not miss a beat. Sort of reminded me of the Soviet Union system, where they bragged that every school child in the same level, was taught the same thing on the same day across the whole vast Soviet Union. So what happens then is, if we're going to then teach, let's say, black literature, then it has to be done by sort of all the teachers infusing it into this more general curriculum. Some of us were better at it than others. Some of us were more interested in it than others. I did not consider myself very good at it. I was somewhat interested in it. You have to understand, though, that especially with, that those teachers who were probably really good at it and really interested in it and who infused a lot of black literature also ran the risk of sort of turning off their white students. None of this is necessarily good or bad. It's just those are the choices you have to make. And I know that just from the education of my two sons, who were, like me, bleeding heart liberals, and who both, especially my first son, delighted in his black friends and loved black music and culture, just getting tired of reading black author after black author after black author. So those were the choices that all the teachers made. And I suspect, I don't know for sure, but I suspect that when it came time for the 10th grade, let's say the advanced 10th graders, to choose which courses they would take in the 11th grade,